This is Soulful Living on Empower Radio. Here's your host, Terry Williams.
Hey, wherever you are in the world today, I welcome you to another 30 minutes of Soulful Living here at Empower Radio. I want to share a little bit about a crazy dream I had the other night. To make a long story short, in my dream, I was literally drowning. And somewhere along the way, I realized that the only way for me to get out of this dream was to physically wake up. And I began screaming at the top of my lungs, "Wake up, wake up, wake up." And interestingly enough, David Bowie joined my dream and he piped in and said, "Wake up, sister, it's not your time." And the reality was I was screaming at the top of my lungs and scared the heck out of my husband. He started shaking me and he's like, "You're screaming, wake up." And I woke up enough to realize that I was screaming, "Wake up." So when I have those kind of crazy dreams, I look at what happened during the day or what happened in my life that might cause me to get carried away, especially down a murky mud hole that I was drowning in, right? Well, sometimes we feel like that in life. And for many years, I have practiced mindfulness through meditation, although I have said to many people, you know, we could probably just flip a switch. It's probably just has nothing to do with meditation. Well, a few weeks ago, my husband sent me a link to Dr. Ellen Langer. Dr. Langer is an award-winning social psychologist who has studied some of the questions that we all ask but don't necessarily look for the answers to. And many people describe her as the mother of mindfulness. So when I reflected on that dream, particularly the part about waking up, I looked at it as my Monday opportunity to learn a different take on mindfulness from Dr. Langer. And so with that said, welcome to Soulful Living, Dr. Langer.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Yeah, so tell me, what does the mother of mindfulness think about that crazy dream I had?
I'm not going to go there. but I will tell you that meditation is a tool to lead to post-meditative mindfulness. And when you think of it as a tool, you recognize that there are many ways, many different kinds of tools, so to speak, to get to the same place. So mindfulness, as I've been studying it for close to 40 years, is the very simple process of actively noticing new things. When you actively notice things, that puts you in the present, makes you sensitive to context and perspective, and it's the essence of engagement. And it's not a practice in the way meditation is. This is just a way of being that follows naturally once one has an awareness that the things they think they know, they really don't know, because everything is always changing. Everything looks different from different perspectives. So if you were to get on a plane, let's say to go to Mexico, and let's assume you've never been to Mexico, and you got off that plane, you'd be primed, waiting to see all sorts of new things. And in that state, you would be mindful. So you can see that it's uplifting. It's not tiring. It's not difficult. And so over the last almost 40 years, we teach people to be mindful. As a result, almost everything improves. People live longer. They're healthier. They're happier. Relationships are better. Memory improves. People are more innovative. It's a lot of years to choose different measures to assess this. So I feel very confident that this is the way people, if they only recognized how easy it was, would choose to be virtually all the time.
Okay, so two of the things that you said there. First of all, I absolutely...
Only two?
Yeah, well, for now, Nate's looking at me doing the same thing. He's like, "Wait, you only have two things? Are we going to be done early here?" But no, two of the things that you just said. First of all, yeah, I totally agree that... Meditation is simply a tool. And man, thank goodness we have so many tools out there, and that it's a choice, right? It could be easy. It's like, to me, it sounds like flipping a switch, you know, by choosing to stay present.
Well, but the problem, you see, is that people don't realize that when they're not there, they're not there. They're not there to know that they're not there. So it's not so easy to stay present when you think that that you're walking around in this conscious, mindful state. Almost everybody, most of the time, is simply not there. They are responding to the world like robots and oblivious to it. Once you recognize that the things you thought you knew you don't know, and you actively notice new things, that puts you in the present. Okay, so it's not just willing, I want to be in the present. Because as soon as you think you know the situation, you know, somebody says to you, hi, how are you? You mindlessly answer, fine, thank you, even though you may be anything but fine at the moment. Much of what we do through the course of the day is based on the assumption that we know, and that we know what this person is like, what this task requires of us, so on. That's why so many people are bored, because they think that they know. So when I give talks, I often ask people simple questions. For example, how much is 1 and 1? And people mindlessly say 2. Well, 1 and 1 is 2 if you're using a base 10 number system. But if you're using a base 2 number system, 1 plus 1 is written as 10. But an easier thing to understand is if you took one pile of snow and you added it to one pile of snow, 1 plus 1 would be 1. So as soon as you recognize that the things you thought you knew, you don't know, then you naturally, easily, without any effort, are in the present.
So it's kind of like deprogramming ourselves, or relearning, or unlearning to openness.
Yes, except that when you put it that way, it sounds effortful. And what's interesting is that this kind of mindfulness is energy begetting, not consuming. It's enlivening. When you're listening to comedy, a joke, for example, is funny for you only when you thought you knew, you know, in what direction it was going, and all of a sudden it took a turn. You know, when you thought it was, the person was saying X and they say not X. I'll give you an example, though. If you don't laugh, that's fine. It's not my day job. But I was told that This clairvoyant midget escaped from prison the other day. There's a small medium at large. Most people don't laugh, but I continue to say it. Anyway, the point is that when you hear the first words, a clairvoyant midget escaped from prison, you don't think of sizes. And when you recognize that it can be understood in this whole different way, so it's new to you, you laugh. The only point that I'm trying to make is that mindfulness is fun, it's easy, and again, it's energy begetting.
In one of your interviews that I watched recently, you talked about how you took a group of elderly men, and I love how you relate the story. So I'm going to have Nate put a link to that interview on your page here. But you talked about how you took a group of elderly men, which you described as not the 80 is the new 60 kind of elderly men.
Right.
And
let me tell you, this study, which I call the counterclockwise study, was the first test of my mind-body unity idea. And it's not difficult, but let me just go through some of the parts to make the theory clear. That right now, people worry about a mind-body problem. And the problem is, how do you get from a fuzzy thing called a thought to something real, the body, something material? And I thought, well, mind, body, these are just words. Let's put the two back together. And then wherever you're putting one, you're necessarily putting the other. And it explains things like placebos and spontaneous remissions. So we took these old men to a retreat that we had retrofitted to 25 years earlier. So we were going to put their minds back 25 years. And they spoke in the present tense about past events. And for in all ways we could accomplish. For them, it was 20 years earlier. Right. As a result of putting their minds in this earlier time, the results we got were amazing. We got, the men first, they looked noticeably younger. Their hearing improved, their vision improved, their memory improved, their strength improved. So that was the first of many studies saying, wait a second, we really have much more control over our health and well-being than most people recognize. So let me give you an example of another study in that series. This is the chambermaids study. We went to chambermaids, and the first thing we did was to ask them, how much exercise do you get? Now, it's interesting, as all of the listeners know, chambermaids are exercising all day long. But it turns out that they don't realize that they're exercising because they see exercise as what you do after work.
And they probably didn't have a Fitbit.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. If they had those, they probably would change their minds. But exercise is defined by the Surgeon General is what you do after work because most people are sitting at desks all day long. Mm-hmm. Anyway, what we did was we taught half of these chambermaids to see their work as exercise. You know, making a bed was like working at this or that machine at the gym and so on. So at the end of this, we have one group that doesn't realize their work is exercise. The other group now sees their work as exercise. We take all sorts of measures before we start. And then at the end of the study, some months later, and we find, did you eat any differently? No. Was she working any harder? No. Everything was the same until we got to the important measures. What we found was those people who now saw their work as exercise, the only change was their mindset. Mm-hmm. Their work was exercise. They lost weight. There was a change in waist to hip ratio, body mass index, and their blood pressure also came down.
It's phenomenal. You know, as someone who used to own a cleaning business, I had several women working for me at one point, and one of my favorite things to do was actually clean some of the houses. Why? Because I never had to work out. I was always working out, so I
as
totally get
as
that.
You, as long as you see it that way. Let
me
tell you, one of we just submitted this paper for review, and most recent test of this mind-body unity idea. So we had people who had type 2 diabetes show up for the study. Mm-hmm. They go through all sorts of tests. Then they sit down at a computer to play a computer game. On the lower right-hand corner is a clock. For a third of the people, the clock is going twice as fast as real. For a third of the people, the clock is going half as fast as real. And for a third of the people, it's real time. And the question we were asking was, would blood sugar level follow real or perceived time?
Wow.
And the answer was perceived time. Again, the control we have over our health and well-being is enormous.
Yeah, talk about mind over matter, right? That you
right.
actually have. I love the title of the book, Counterclockwise, Mindful Health and the Power of Possibility, because we talk about and we hear all the time the power of the mind, but your studies have put to, you know, physical evidence that there is more than meets the eye there.
Right, right. We have several studies that assess this from different ways. One is these counterclockwise studies.
Mm-hmm.
So where we put people back in time and then their bodies cooperate, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Another way we do this is to get people to attend to the variability in their symptoms. And all that means is noticing the changes in their symptoms. Right now, for most people, you go to the doctor, you're given a diagnosis, and you just assume that's what you have. And you don't pay any close attention to your body. By getting you to attend to, let's say you have chronic pain, one of the studies we did, and we might contact you at various times, random times in the course of the day, and ask you how you feel. Well, it turns out, of course, you never feel the same, exactly the same way. And so the first question is, do you feel better or worse? And people will say they feel better or worse. And the next question is, why? Now, what happens is that when you try to figure out why you feel differently now than you did the last time we called, you're going through a mindful search for an answer. And all of our early studies say that that's very good for your health. And you may find the answer. But let me give you an example. Let's say you have, you go to the doctor and you're told you have asthma. For most people, they just assume they're always going to have the asthma. That's all there is to it. When they need the inhaler, they'll reach for the inhaler. Let's say you pay attention to when you need the inhaler and when you don't. So you found that when you were talking to Nate, you didn't need the inhaler. When you were talking to Ellen Langer, you needed the inhaler. Well, the solution to your asthma is very simple. Don't talk to Ellen Langer.
Right.
Or make the conversations with her similar to the conversations with Nate, Terry, whoever. The point is that once we recognize that everything is always changing, we realize that our symptoms are always changing. Now we can get some control over them. And we do the same thing interpersonally. You might say that your husband is an ex. He always does whatever it is. And but nobody always does anything. And by paying attention to when he does it, when he doesn't do it, first you become less frustrated with him. You know, if he always snores and wakes you up, except when you're having those awful dreams, that would be very different from seeing that, oh, it's only when the two of you stay out too late that he snores that way. Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
As soon as you realize that things don't always happen, then you have an opportunity to exercise some control.
Well, and the connection to it, you know, what's the connection to what's happening here? And I like what you said, you can just change how you interact with Nate. So now Nate and I are just going to have a great time. We're going to make it more fun and lightheaded. And then I'm going to have that same conversation with Dr. Langer to make it more fun and lightheaded so that my asthma doesn't escalate. I got it.
So another thing that this mindfulness ends up teaching you is that behavior makes sense from the actor's perspective, or else the actor wouldn't do it. So that means that every time you call somebody by some negative evaluative name, you're misjudging, because nobody wakes up in the morning and says, you know, today I'm going to be lazy, rigid, fickle, or whatever. So what are they intending from their perspective? And when you see that the person you're calling rigid was intending to be stable, someone you could count on, the person you saw as impulsive was being spontaneous, the person you saw as gullible was actually trusting. When you do this, then again, relationships improve, because, you know, if I saw you as impulsive, I might try to change. I'd be frustrated by you. It wouldn't be good for me. It wouldn't be good for our relationship. Once I see that actually you're being spontaneous, now I don't want to trust you. I actually enjoy you.
Mm-hmm. So listeners, I'm chatting with Dr. Ellen Langer, who, as I had said earlier in the show, has been described as the mother of mindfulness. She has written extensively on the illusion of control, mindful aging, stress, decision making, and health. And some of the examples, if you're just tuning in, you might want to go back and listen to, because she gives some really solid examples on how we can increase our overall health by being more than just present, but paying attention. You know, so Dr. Langer, I say paying attention, but to me that's an act. So what are some of the simplest ways that a person practicing?
People don't realize, I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
People don't realize that they're not paying attention. What you have to do, it's very simple. Just notice new things. So new things about your husband, new things about your work, new things about the weather, your home, everything is new, because everything looks different from different perspectives and everything is always changing. As you look for this novelty, that again puts you in the present. So let me talk for a moment, if you want, about stress, because this is, I think, probably the number one, literally the number one killer in the world. I think that people don't recognize that stress is not a function of events that you experience. Stress is a function of the view you take of an event. Mm. Now, when you take a mindless view, the assumption that this thing is going to happen and it's going to be awful, of course you're going to be stressed. But we do work where we get people to question both parts of that. The first is, you know, you're stressed when you think something is going to happen. If you simply said to yourself, what are three reasons that it might not happen? And all of a sudden it goes from this thing will definitely happen to maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. Now, everything cuts multiple ways. So the second part is when you say this thing is going to be awful, ask yourself for 3-5 reasons why, in fact, it might be a blessing in disguise. And then at the end of this, and you do this long enough, you come to realize that you can't really predict and that that's okay because the consequences you experience are of your own making. The thing in and of itself isn't good or bad. You know, I go into a restaurant and the food is awful. That's good. I'll eat less, possibly. And, you know, and then I won't gain weight. Or the food is wonderful, and that's good.
Somebody and it's non-caloric.
What?
I said, and that it has no calories. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah. The point is that we think that there are things that are good out there and we must have them. Or we think there are things that are bad and we must stay away from them. And that keeps us reactive to the world rather than simply responsive. Once you recognize that whether it's good, bad, or indifferent is up to you, not the event, then you can be still and responsive to your world.
I think it's awesome to be able to look at something, first of all, and say the view, you know, your stress is the view you take of it. You know, it's how you look at it. And then to be able to look at three reasons that something might not happen, or of course I'm really into looking at the positivity in life and, you know, kind of a Pollyanna attitude. So I am definitely gravitate to 5 reasons why it might be a blessing in disguise.
Yeah.
You know, instead of, you know, looking at it from the perspective of, oh my God, this is going to suck, to, you know, oh my God, what's going to happen here? This could be really awesome.
Right. Exactly.
I could get a raise today. Nate, don't forget to tell our boss. Okay.
Another thing that your listeners might find useful is some work we're doing on bullying. When you're feeling bullied, and this is not just for kids, this is, throughout life, there are people who feel intimidated by others, and that makes them stressed, uncomfortable, just unhappy, and that's going to make them unhealthy, and so on. If one recognizes that nobody who has it together, nobody who is truly successful, bullies people, Donald Trump aside.
Yeah.
And so when you realize that the bully is weak rather than strong, the response that helps one is to feel sorry for the bully, because nobody successful would behave that way. So then rather than feeling like a victim, you turn the whole situation around. And, you know, so someone is unkind to you, rather than feel small and hurt by it, you recognize that if this person were, fully grown up, somebody who deserved your respect, they wouldn't behave this way. So instead, you feel sorry for them.
Which in turn empowers yourself, you know, like you said, not necessarily being the victim. Okay, well, Dr. Langer, we're down to the wire here. We only have about 1.5 minutes left. And listeners, you can find all of Dr. Langer's information here on the Soulful Living page at Empower Radio. And Dr. Langer, I love for my guests to leave the listeners with one thought that they can take out into the day to empower themselves and, turn their life around. What would that one thought be for you?
Is for people to recognize that life only consists of moments. Mm. So if you make the moment matter, your life will matter. Mm. And I guess that's it.
That is pretty amazing. Well, and it's really true. You know, it really does only consist of moments. Thank you for that thought. And thank you for joining me here today. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to sharing your work in the future and putting some of these teachings into practice myself. So thank you, Dr. Langer.
Now, my pleasure. I think that we should just repeat that all one has to do is treat everything as if it's brand new. Mm-hmm. And notice the way it's new, and that's literally and figuratively enlivening.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.